Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. A quick shout out, this being the modern equivalent of a tip of the hat, to Richard, who has made a significant donation to help me host this series. I was flabbergasted upon receiving the PayPal payment, Richard. We have communicated over the years, so this is just to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. When I'm next in Ireland, I promise to buy you a couple of rounds of St. James's Blessing. This is episode 228. Dust to Destiny, the Diamond Trail begins in 1867. What's this? A cacophony of digging? Must be significant. Well, the date is somewhere in March 1867, a month after young Erasmus Jacobs had found an interesting stone near Hopetown, which was on the border of the Free State, but also close to the newly formed Transvaal and the older Griqualand. A few errant strands of fate, previously flapping about like ribbons in a gale, were now reaching for one another, soon to be braided, not into a neat narrative, but into a ponytail of history, so improbably tidy it could only exist in hindsight. To gnarl a saying or two, the thread was about to pull tight, the tail to wag the epoch, and the whole lot to be tied off with a bow borrowed from destiny's hatbox. Sorry, that's a little carried away. But it's also probably an understatement because we speak, of course, of treasure, of diamonds. These gemstones have titillated and scintillated, not to put too fine a point on it. The world of diamonds swirls with myth and legend, fiction and fact. Diamonds glitter with dangerous promise, alluring but transient in their fortunes, hard as truth and just as capable of cutting those who reach for them unprepared. The rock that was found at Hopetown was placed on the table of the Cape Assembly shortly thereafter by Sir Richard Southey, the colonial secretary, with these words: "Gentlemen, this is the rock on which the future success of South Africa will be built." This was only partially correct because gold, believe it or not, would eventually eclipse the treasures of South Africa's diamonds. Still, within 20 years, four farms north of the Orange River would find themselves the center of the global diamond mining industry and effectively under control of one man, Cecil John Rhodes. While the oxidized green statue that once loomed near the University of Cape Town was ceremonially toppled by the Rhodes Must Fall movement, a kind of bronze beheading with academic applause, his legacy inconveniently still stands rather tall in the banking system's mining deeds and oddly shaped trusts. But here we are, tripping into an epoch. So allow a quick note about that statue. Strangely, Rhodes's statue didn't face Cairo, despite the fevered imperial cartography of Rhodes's Cape to Cairo pipe dream. Instead, it looked out over Guguletu and Khayelitsha across the wind-blown Cape Flats towards False Bay, which frankly is perfect because few things capture the colonial imagination better than looking in entirely the wrong direction. A dream deferred, then derailed, and finally mounted on a plinth with pigeon guano on its head. And yet relevant because 120 years after his death, folks still wanted to do him in. Diamonds have long dazzled more than just lovers. They charm the powerful, whisper to billionaires, and glitter quietly in the pockets of empires over eons. Take Shah Zaman, born in 1470, a Timurid prince, the younger brother of Zahir ud-Din Muhammad Babur, who'd go on to found the Mughal Empire in 1526. The Timurid dynasty were descendants of the conqueror Temelane, who ruled parts of Central Asia and Persia in the 15th century. But by Shah Zaman's time, it was fragmenting. Zaman ruled Kabul briefly between 1494 and 1501. His hold on power was tenuous. Babur, who was just 11 years old when he inherited the small kingdom of Ferghana, quickly emerged as a rival claimant. In the fierce competition among Timurid princes, Zaman was captured and blinded, which was a common political tactic in Central and South Asian courts to ensure that rivals could not claim the throne. Blinding symbolized the loss of divine favor and the physical ability to rule, a kind of living death in royal terms. Over the centuries, though, a legend grew that Shah Zaman had been blinded not just as a matter of dynastic politics, but because he had knowledge or access to hidden treasure, diamonds, which were already objects of immense value in Indian and Persian courts. While there's no hard historical evidence linking his punishment to diamonds specifically, the idea stuck that his downfall was tied not just to ambition, but to proximity to immense glittering wealth. thus the link between myth and diamonds. There are other myths and legends with great and glorious narratives. In the 18th century, during the height of Brazil's diamond boom in Minas Gerais, enslaved Africans were forced to labor in brutal conditions in the riverbeds and gravel pits, sifting through mud in search of the crown's wealth. Diamonds were owned not by the finders, but by the Portuguese crown, and anyone, enslaved or free, who was caught hiding a stone would be whipped, mutilated, and then probably executed. One day, so the story goes, a young enslaved woman, often unnamed but sometimes called Rosa or Esperanza, was working in a diamond field near the town of Diamantina when her fingers brushed against an unusually large and glittering stone. She handed it over to the overseer. It turned out to be a diamond of remarkable size and clarity, fit for royalty, and in a rare moment of grace, the Portuguese governor at the time, impressed by her honesty and perhaps eager to set an example, granted her freedom. She was freed, given a document affirming her liberty, and in some accounts, some money to begin her new life. This story was repeated across the region, not because of its rarity, but because it captured a moral contradiction of the time, that in a world built on theft and bondage, the one who did not steal was considered exceptional. Thus the myth. The world of diamonds is thick with myth and half-remembered legend, stories told in whispers, scrawled in old ledgers, buried in dust beside the stones themselves. Dreams cling to them like light, but the facts often slip through the fingers. For every verified carat, there's a tale of lost treasure, of rivers that once sparkled, of fortunes made and vanished. In the diamond fields, truth is rarely naked. It comes wrapped in rumour, polished by time, and carried from one generation to the next with just enough shine to blur the lines between what was and what we need to believe. Before Southey's dramatic flourish, the initial response from officialdom was disbelief, for as long as anyone could remember. And this went all the way back to the VOC in the 1660s. There had been rumours of great mineral treasure in the north. A kind of disinformation campaign was launched by Jan van Riebeck because from the time of his arrival, he expressed belief in the possibility of a successful search for the traditional golden realm of Monomotapa. It was imperative to drum up more cash for the new Tavern of the Seas, and he was trying to convince the VOC of the exaggerated value of their new outpost. After Jan van Riebeck left the Cape with a sigh of relief, it must be said, Simon van der Stel sent a few expeditions north in search of copper, but no large deposits were discovered. In 1785, as a measure of last resort, he headed off himself. By the 1860s, the world had already seen its fair share of treasure hunt, some spectacularly real, others painfully illusory. Gold rushes in California, Australia, and the Klondike had transformed regions overnight, but not all cries of riches had borne fruit. In places like Chile and parts of Brazil, the promised wealth often fizzled into hardship and regret. So when rumours began to circulate of diamonds in Griqualand West, many officials, scientists and fortune seekers remained sceptical. In colonial circles, such claims were dismissed as exaggerated or the work of overeager amateurs mistaking quartz for something more precious. The land seemed too dry, too remote, too implausible, and so, while a few quietly persisted in their search, the rush did not come, not yet. It would be two more years before the first glint of proof turned out into frenzy. The fact that there really were diamonds hidden away was a cruel twist for all of those earlier folks, including the Griqua of Adam Cook III, who trekked away. As you've heard, by the 1850s, copper was being mined in the mountains of Little Namaqualand. This was all taking place at a time of industrial revolution. New transport systems meant that these could be reached. New banks were available for loans. It was a dynamic place. And folks, it was a bit like the dot-com revolution, like the social media platform explosion, like the AI horizon of the moment, promising riches, but only a handful end up running the show. Geology in the 1860s was in its formative phase. And women in South Africa were taking notice, which probably from a 21st century point of view appears somewhat unlikely. More about Mary Elizabeth Barber in a few minutes. The year 1867 was characterized by drought and a severe depression made worse by reports that the completion of the Suez Canal would ruin all trade with the Cape. So it wasn't a moment too soon, so to speak, that diamonds were discovered. Nearly 200 years had passed since van der Stel's memorable expedition across what he called the Grote Rivier, the Garib, the Orange. It was on the Orange River, 60 kilometers above its junction with the Vaal, that a village sprang up, Hopetown. By all reports, a thriving little settlement, with a number of farms dotted along the riverbanks nearby. Close by lived the Karana and the Griqua, at the towns of Peniel and Hebron. The stolid Boer pioneers rolled their wagons across these diamond fields of the future. The Karana and the Griqua herded over them, and the sand had hunted over them for well over 2,500 years. When colonial geologist Wiley headed off to the Free State in 1856 to investigate reports of gold in the thin veins of quartzite lining the joints and crevices of rocks around Smithfield, he detoured through Foreesmith. He stood on the edge of the farm Jagersfontein, later the seat of a prolific diamond mine, and found nothing. Switch to 1867. Picture the scene, sheep and goats. Erasmus Jacobs was doing what boys did. He was roaming the veld, playing on the edge of the river. Here were garnets with their rich carmine flush, the fainter rose of the carnelian, the bronze of jasper, the thick cream of chalcedony, agates of motley hues, rock crystals shining in the light like beckoning stars, lesser stones, not diamonds, nor valuable gems. From one of these multicoloured beds, Erasmus and his siblings filled their pockets with stones, thinking they could play a game of ducks and drakes. For the uninitiated town-based gaslight grazer, ducks and drakes is a game of skimming stones. Whomever skims the stone the furthest, or with the most hops, wins. Simple game, but when you have no toys, stones are your best friends. Luckily for the future of South Africa, Erasmus decided against skimming the diamond and took it home. There it joined a pile of other shining stones he'd collected like a magpie. It was odd, this stone, and his widowed mother, Mrs. Jacobs, mentioned it to a neighbour, farmer Meneer Skulk van Niekerk. Skulk asked to see it. By the time the newly widowed Miss Jacobs and van Niekerk returned to the house, a younger child had already taken the shiny object and flung it into the yard. It took some time to find, half lost, half buried, swallowed up in a river of dust, like something out of The Lord of the Rings. Van Niekerk retrieved the stone and rubbed it clean. His eyes widened, and he offered to buy it, but Mrs. Jacobs was sick and tired of all these stones in her house. "You can keep the stone," she is reported to have said, "if you want it." Meneer Van Niekerk wanted it, all right. He wasn't sure what it was, but had a vague notion, he wrote later, that it may have had some value. A couple of weeks later, a travelling trader passed by, John O'Reilly. He looked the very Victorian that he was, large mutton chop beard and moustache. A photo shows him staring into the middle distance. There was a tradition of showing precious stones to Jewish traders at the time, which O'Reilly did in Hopetown and Colesberg. None would pay a penny for the rock, the diamond. One said merely, "It is a pretty stone enough, probably a topaz." Striding onto this historical stage right now is Lorenzo Boys, the acting civil commissioner at Colesberg. He took one look at the stone Van Niekerk handed him, and he said convincingly, "I believe it to be a diamond." I've been reading original letters from this time, some collected by Cape mining engineer Alpheus Williams in his book Some Dreams Come True. Fascinating reading, because at this point, no one knew what the stone was. After Boys convincingly concluded that the shiny pebble was a diamond, town apothecary Dr. Kish, who was present, commented, "Nonsense! I'll bet Boys a new hat. It is only a topaz." Boys shook hand with Dr. Kish on the bet and sent the stone to the Cape's principal mineralogist, Dr. Gieborn Atherston, living in Grahamstown. Boys didn't even bother to seal the envelope and sent it by regular postcard. He must have had his doubts. Dr. Atherston dropped the stone when he opened the unsealed envelope, and it rolled away across the floor. He bent down, picked it up, examined the pebble with expert eyes, did a few tests. Then he sat down to compose a letter to Boys.
"I congratulate you on the stone you have sent me. It is a veritable diamond, weighs 21 1/4 carats, and is worth £500.
A handful of jeweler's files were ruined in an attempt to cut it, the true test of a diamond. Atherston sent the diamond to Southey, the colonial secretary, who then presented it to the Cape Assembly, as you heard earlier. This moment was a revelation, which was going to transform the despised Karooland as the grimy Cinderella was transfigured by the wand of her fairy godmother. But it wasn't instant transformation. Cape Governor Philip Roadhouse examined the diamond, so too the French consul Henriette, called the best judge of an uncut diamond in South Africa. In typical French flair, he wrote a piece for local media, printed by Saul Solomon & Co.'s steam printing office in Cape Town, 1867, which ended with these words. It belongs to the class of diamonds of the purest water which comes from India, and which, as everyone knows, far surpasses that coming from the Brazils. This is, I think, a matter of encouragement for all diamond searchers of the Cape, and also those desponding colonists who expect nothing but general bankruptcy for the Cape colony. All apologies to Peter Sellers. And thus, dear listener, this is the story of the first diamond found in South Africa, the O'Reilly Diamond. Mysteriously, Henriette spoke of a second diamond being sent to Paris, but of this one, we have never heard a word since. As with all matters regarding diamonds, there's much myth and cloak and dagger. Many people flocked to the Paris exhibition to view the first diamond. The second had vanished. Most visitors who appeared at the O'Reilly Diamond were sceptical. Diamonds were always being reported from various parts of the globe, often dropped, and then apparently discovered by devious men, hoping to make a quick buck off the ensuing rush of treasure hunters. Enter the next unsung hero, history is sort of forgotten, John Blades Curry, who was appointed to represent the Cape at the Paris exhibition. He was in France and was at the show before the diamond arrived, and when Curry had models cut of the brilliant diamond, well, the Parisian elite just fobbed him off. Later, Curry wrote in his book, Half a Century in South Africa, that it was impossible to even get the London Illustrated News to publish a picture of this diamond. All those red herrings, all those stories of gold rushes and diamond rushes had burned out the poor old press. None of the scientific specialists of the day would entertain issuing any statement to the effect that the Cape was a diamond-producing country. Yes, in those days, the Cape was regarded as a country. But at the time of these rejections, the real possibility dawned on some. After all, there was a striking similarity between the Indian, Brazilian, and South African geology for a start, romance and myth aside. Among those who pursued the science were Dr. Gray of Craddock, Wiley, the Cape Geological Surveyor, Dr. Atherston of Grahamstown, and Mary Elizabeth Barber. She's really important in our tale. More about her in a sec. Back in South Africa, Lorenzo Boys set off to explore Hope Town and the farms around Vernikirk's land, hoping to scoop up a few more diamonds. He prodded the Boer men for news, interviewed the black workers, cajoled the kids, and raked over bushes and pebbles himself for 2 weeks, looking for the blink clipper, as the locals called it. Nothing, nada, nux. It took 10 more months before a second diamond, or third, if you take the mysterious missing rock into account, was found. This time, it was a location almost 60 kilometres from Hope Town, below the junction of the Vaal and Orange Rivers. Boys was beginning to think that these diamonds were being washed down the river from further up. A few more small diamonds were discovered in Korana territory, and by now Atherston was being ridiculed in the Cape press, who disbelieved the diamonds were anything but a small anomaly. Worse, they wrote about Atherston's incompetency. Atherston stuck to his guns and called for proper geological research. This is where Mary Elizabeth Barber re-enters our tale. She was the eldest daughter of Miles Barker, an 1820 settler we heard quite a bit about in earlier episodes. Her brother was John Mitford Barker, who was also featured quite a bit during the episodes covering the frontier wars. Among Mary's many interests were geology and prehistory. She called her passion geologizing. By 1846, she was already using the new term Pleistocene in the same way as one of the fathers of geology, Sir Charles Lyell. This was the term characterizing rock deposits in which 90 to 95% of fossil species contained within are still to be found in modern times. It's now the name given to the period after the last ice age. Still, you get the picture. She was obsessed with rocks, a bit like Boys, but from an academic standpoint, living with her husband, Frederick William Barber, in Grahamstown. She was friends with Richard Nathaniel Rubridge and George William Stowe. The latter recorded sand paintings assiduously and also went on to discover the most important coal reserves in South Africa. Mary Elizabeth Barber, in many ways, was one of the chaperones of South African geology. She was one of these second generation of Britons who'd emigrated to the Cape Colony and had transcended the basic requirements of establishing a subsistence among the relatively inhospitable social, economic, and agricultural climate of their new homeland. These people became amateur historians, geologists, naturalists, ethnologists. Most of the members of these new groups of budding scientists were connected in some way to Mary Elizabeth Barber. She was to become a well-known artist and poet and natural historian, corresponding with leading British scientists of the day, including Sir Joseph Hooker and Charles Darwin himself. At first, she was also skeptic about the diamond discoveries sitting on her farm outside Grahamstown. It was there in 1867 she heard about her friend Dr. Gibbon Atherston's inspection of the diamond she regarded as a once-off. However, in March 1869, a second, much more important diamond was found, this time an 83.5-carat behemoth known as the Star of South Africa, picked up by Skalk van Niekerk. A shepherd brought him a pure white diamond and tentatively asked for 500 ewes, 10 oxen, and a horse in exchange. Van Niekerk coughed up the livestock on the same day. Thus began what was to become a close relationship between farmers of the Transoranje and a hidden trade in diamonds. Some say it continues to this day. Skalk sold the diamond to Lilienfield Brothers of Hopetown for, wait for it, £11,200. That's £1.7 million in today's money, or 42 million rand. Lilienfield Brothers promptly sold the huge diamond to Lord Dudley of the UK for £50,000, £4.5 million. Just a quick look at my calculator, around 114 million rand. Upon hearing about this, the famous Cape Diamond skeptic and London-based Harry Emmanuel published this retraction shortly thereafter.
I am very anxious to state that there no longer exists any doubt in my mind of the Cape Colony being a diamond-producing country.
By June 1870, Mary Barber's husband and eldest son had leapt aboard a wagon heading to Hopetown from Grahamstown. A diamond fever had broken out. Mary Barber writes,
"It was not the newspaper reports which set our people a-going. It was private letters from the diamond fields, from relations of ours, letters of which there can be no doubt of their truth."
They were receiving these letters before the newspaper reports. Word of mouth started the stampede. The press completed it. Mary changed her mind. She thought the diamonds were merely a surface phenomenon and would fade fast. But all reports, both official and personal, indicated that the Cape was going to indeed become a major diamond-producing country. Treasure hunters descended on the rough, scrubby veld, a landscape that beneath its coarse surface held unimaginable value. Lorenzo Boys had long insisted that diamonds lay hidden in Griqualand West, waiting to be uncovered in abundance. Atherston had backed him, and now vindication shimmered on the horizon as hundreds arrived, drawn by the promise of fortune buried in the dust. I'm not of Mr. Boys, the Colesberg commissioner, who held firm to his belief in diamonds, even when others mocked him. History proved him correct. The gems were indeed there, but not for him. Despite his foresight, despite the years spent searching, Boys never found his own fortune. Others grew rich on the brilliance he had long foreseen, while he was left only with the solitary satisfaction of having known the truth before the world was ready to believe it. So here's to South Africans like Mr. Boys, the ones whose vision is clear, whose timing is not, and whom history remembers only after the treasure rush has moved on. Next week we focus on national goings-ons heading into the significant 1870s. The Boers and the Basutu have called a truce, and the East, Cetshwayo, is about to take charge of the AmaZulu nation, and the future mining powerhouses of South Africa are beginning to take shape. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about various episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, happy hunting.